Wave trapped in the interface between air and earth was not quite known. Only in 1956, Dr. Gobow created his Gobow G-Line, which was called Trump-Sommerfeld Gobow G-Line, and that was called with the name of Sommerfeld, who in 1908 first discovered it. Now, the good thing would be to go to specification, what is the ground wave, what is the surface wave, but we're going to leave it at the end of it. So the newer paper from 2012, I believe, they put two guys underwater with two handy talkies, and they were trying to get something from that. But before we go to it, I need to say a few words. What about those ULF, ELF frequencies, what they are standing for? So from 0.1 to 100 hertz, the frequency hertz, the frequency range covers ULF, ultra-low frequency band. The frequencies that are extremely low, that are less than 5 hertz called ELF, and frequencies in range from 5 hertz to 3 hertz, 2 kilohertz, 3 kilohertz, ELF is frequencies in range 5 hertz to 3 kilohertz. So that was the formulation what we're talking about, and that was our 1976 paper. The new one, they put two guys underwater with walkie-talkie. They first found out an interesting thing that at frequency of 550 megahertz, the efficient for launching surface electromagnetic waves, so again, they are underwater, but the wave goes over the water on the earth and air, which air is dielectric and the seawater. The seawater is lossy conducting medium and the air is dielectric, so we have an interface. And what they find out is that the tip of an antenna, there was impedance matching of antenna enclosure which was filled with deionized water, and that allows them to improve coupling of electromagnetic energy to the salt water medium, and the antenna could be shorter because it resonates at that dimension better. So they put those two guys and they gave him walkie-talkie, and then they were trying to make the experiment at 50 megahertz. They find out that those two guys underwater were talking over the surface. So they and you have that not a paper. So interesting. Now, if we go to the what frequency does what at 30 kilohertz, we have meteorology, climatology, physics of high atmosphere and astrophysics, geophysics, seismology, and special telecommunication. At 20.8 hertz, and 27.3 hertz, and 33.7, and whatever, we have Winfried or Otto Schumann, that is Schumann resonance. Interesting is that Schumann discovered Schumann's resonance in 1952, and Gobow was 1956-55. It says how fast the technology went at this time. We have very low frequency EM that is generated by human activities. Remember what I said at the beginning of it, what is the frequency of 0.1 hertz to 100 hertz? It is not used. Yeah, 50 hertz we have in the wire, but how about the electromagnetic wave? Well, have radio transmitters operating frequency range from 9 kilohertz to 90 kilohertz, and use direct radio link with the civil military vessels. But they were transmitting at 76 hertz with two antennas located at Klein Lake, Wisconsin, at one, and one other was in the Republic, Michigan. Okay, I don't know. Anyhow, Russian developed similar system that was 82 hertz, and they were transmitting from Kola Peninsula, from Murmansk, to their submarines in ERF, VLF, ionospheric heating experiments. They were doing some kind of very weird stuff. Okay, so now we have a situation where we need to say a few words about attenuation of the electromagnetic wave in the atmosphere from the gases or other things. So we have water vapor, carbon dioxide, and ozone. We have some gases at the atmosphere, and some radiation is attenuated by those factors. And then we will go to the next one, electromagnetic wave radiation due to the diastrophism of magma dike, which is the eruption in Japan in 2000. So we're talking now about a natural phenomena where the ground was moving. I think I properly pronounced diastrophism. Okay. And we have a creation of the frequency from 10 to 300 hertz for natural reasons. I don't know what is the origin exactly of that, but that happened to help geophysicists to predict some of the earthquake in the future, because that Japanic volcanic eruption and then earthquake was in 2000, year 2000. And now I have a question for you, Dr. Roy, and others, ground waves. So what is the difference between ground wave and the surface wave? Back to you.
When we talk, by the way, AC2GS, when we talk about ground waves, we're just talking about propagation of waves that are not going into the sky and being refracted off the ionosphere.
How about surface waves?
I don't think we're alluding to surface wave phenomena. That's a little bit more esoteric than the average ham is aware of. You know, there's those questionable, those good old Zenic wave things, and people kind of write the theoretical constructs, but as far as the practical terms, I haven't heard too many hams talk about plane waves.
Well, a plane wave is geometrical construct that is helping to understand the nature of electromagnetic wave propagation. Propagation 2. The ground waves are radio waves propagating parallel to adjacent to the surface of the Earth following the curvature of the Earth I'm reading. This radiation is known as a Norton surface wave, or more deeply, Norton ground wave, because ground waves in radio propagation are not confined to the surface. So now you have a last word, not confined to the surface. What I deeply oppose, and that was my problem with Dick before, is that few dinosaurs cannot really understand that the technology is moving and understanding of electromagnetic waves is moving, and the application of some force of a trapped wave is proved. And when we're talking about the waveguides, we know about the interfaces. And the interface is two-dimensional waveguide, and the wave travels in it. Okay. And that's why I believe some people don't want to touch the surface wave. The surface wave is used in modern radars. There is a significant significant use of surface waves. Because of what? Because some people are afraid of a descriptor that is officially said, and it could be also found in the Wikipedia, that there is a type of surface wave, not all of the surface wave, but there's a type of surface wave that is not radiative. Band mode, Zenex surface wave, Zenex Sommerfeld surface wave. The Earth has one of the refractive index, and the atmosphere has the other. Those constituting an interface that supports the guided Zenex wave transmission. And that's the... I just read the description of it. And it's scientifically proven. Okay. So, it looks like nobody wants to answer. What is the surface wave? I said about one reason of it. I have a number of papers from U.S. military. They are using radars on surface waves. So I don't understand. What is the problem? Enter it here.
The problem, among other things, is this is not particularly new technology. You know, when you call people dinosaurs because they don't want to contemplate a rather obscure, technical, somewhat explanation is convoluted and guarded, and cite a paper that was written in 1923. I don't know who's the dinosaur. Whenever this gets discussed, there's always these conditional aspects to it that give people the impression that no one's quite sure what they're talking about themselves. So, and how they apply to our experiences as opposed to very, very, very low frequencies that none of us have anything really much to do with except, you know, the alternating current that comes into our house. It's esoteric, it's conditionally defined, it tends to be parsed in a theoretical construct which doesn't make people comfortable. You want to have something that can be described without conditional aspects to it. And surface wave phenomena has loads of conditional aspects to it. So, and again, I would not call 1923 state-of-the-art technology. And it's still somewhat esoteric in my mind. You knew Dick's opinion. If there's anyone out there who has any differing opinion, this seems to be kind of universal for both electrical engineers and for amateur radio operators. It's kind of out of their field. And I don't mind discussing things that are out of our field. Sometimes it can be rather fascinating. And I know you have a particular love for surface wave phenomena.
The thing is that in paper of 2018, 2022, 2013, 2012, 1965, 1976, prepared by reputated educational facilities, surface wave is dominantly present. We have a physical use, not only theoretical abstract, but physical use of surface wave. And when I go to one of the papers prepared for the government, it says, introduction, the performance of antennas operated near the surface of the Earth can be strongly affected by the interaction with the Earth and by surface wave propagation. And it is related to antenna analysis, ground stake, radial wire, ground screen, beverage antenna, and vertical hub rhombic antenna. So, who's right, who's wrong? Enter it here.
It's not a matter of who's right or who's wrong. There are surface interfaces that interact with ground wave propagation. whether you want to extract that and extrapolate other aspects of surface wave phenomena, I don't know what it gets you. You know, these people tend to make claims that are completely unfounded, unprovable, and unreproducible. And that causes me problems. And there's lots of papers written in a lot of places that are meaningless. I think the overwhelming majority of scientific papers today, unfortunately, are worthless because there's an old adage that's very, very true, publish or perish. So there's a lot of guys doing worthless stuff, bad stuff, publishing it in dubious publications. Usually they charge the researcher to publish his stuff, which usually denotes that they're just out to make a buck. So unfortunately, there's a lot of scientific literature that's worth nothing. Recently, someone had one of these artificial AIs write complete nonsense into a scientific article and got it published. So, yeah, that's what that means when you say that something is published. It doesn't mean much. Now, there's something to it. I don't know how much there is to it. I don't know how it relates to amateur radio operators or electrical engineers or anyone. So, I understand that you are really intrigued by it and you think that it's a method to unlock a lot of special things, which I don't think. It can act as a waveguide, but it's an imperfect waveguide. And, you know, G-lines are not used regularly because they're imperfect. All these things break down given enough of a lens, and so they are not scalable to any kind of useful technology, as far as I'm aware. This might change over time, but it hasn't yet.
Well, the G-line by Gobo was actually the discovery of the interface. So the electromagnetic wave doesn't go through the wire, doesn't go through the dielectric. And they use the interface that's between the conductive medium, which is the wire, and the coating, which is the dielectric, the best Teflon. And then they went further. They found that that could be flat, slap, interface. That could be not only between the conductive medium and dielectric, it could be kind of dielectric and dielectric. And a number of devices that they're using in electronics. One of them, I believe, in iPhone, is based on that interface. Okay, now, when we're talking about salt water, and then we're talking about air, we know that air is dielectric and salt water is a conductive medium. It's a lossy conductive medium, but it's a conductive medium. Now we have the interface. And we have a paper standing over it, and I have a dozen of those papers, but I have also dozens of the information about it and the physical devices they are done. It's just the matter of acceptance. It's just a matter of moving forward. I do really respect Dr. Roy, and I just want to push to the point at which someone would be able to say, hey, maybe Wesley has some merits. Maybe he is not right, but he has some merits. Let's check it out. Let's check if that military technology used by the United States of America and given to the Ukraine right now that is using surface wave is really using surface wave. Because they say it's using surface wave. And it's a grand propagation. And to exceed.
Wesley, Dick before me, and I've given you the opportunity to expound upon these concepts. But I've kind of demonstrated my general skepticism to a lot of things that you brought to the net. And this is just another case. Again, is there something called surface waves? Yeah, there's planar waves. Yeah. Is it quite as magical as sometimes you present it? I don't think so. Does it have practical uses? Possibly. Do I know of any? Absolutely not, but maybe I'm just stupid. I don't know. At this point, every time you kind of send me a video, if it's a real established individual, they prevaricate and conditionalize everything they talk about. They call about so-called Zenic waves. They call about so-called this, so-called that. So, you know, I discern a kind of border edge of provable science. Maybe I'm incorrect in my assessment, but I can only base things on my own judgment and my own knowledge. And as much as I'd love to say I agree 100% with you, Wesley, I'm still skeptical. I'm still open to it because I'm letting you talk about it tonight. But you have to understand that a lot of people don't quite understand the concept in general. And I still remember trying to explain Zenic waves to Dick, and he was not a happy camper about them. So, you know, I mean, I don't know what to tell you, Wesley. You're going to get some skepticism here. If you want a bunch of people to just kind of say yes to whatever you say, I don't know where to send you.
No, I completely understand what you're saying. I do. I tried to not talk about it, but it's like when I have a certain subject to discuss, I have to mention what is the surface wave, and the surface wave is omitted. Although surface wave is the official term. So you may be skeptic about the Zenic wave or whatsoever, but the surface wave is the official term. You go to Wikipedia at first to find out about it. The reason that Dick was opposing it because he couldn't understand how come the wave is not radiative. How is it possible that the wave is not radiative? And it's easy. It enters the interface through the complex Brewster angle. But that's okay, fine. I have no problem with that. What I'm saying is, it's good sometimes to move. You have a right to your opinion, I have a right to my opinion, and I do agree with you, you have the boss. So thank you very much, I appreciate your time and attendance. And to you.
Okay, you're welcome, Wesley. And I don't want to be the Dick whisperer and reinterpret Dick. I don't think that was his problem because Dick certainly knew a great deal about waveguides also do not radiate. There's nothing wrong with things that operate primarily as transmission lines that do not radiate. So I don't think his problem was with the non-radiating nature of these of Zenic waves. I think he had a problem with the fact that they don't have a loss over distance. The way you presented it was very much like a lossless waveguide in which it didn't expand in three-dimensional space. I guess on the surface it would expand in two-dimensional space, and so it would have a 1 over R inverse law as opposed to a 1 over R squared. But that was, I think, his primary dislike for the concept of Zenic waves. But we'll leave it for another day. Once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break any kind of technical net, and I appreciate every last one of you. But it is 10:30 and a little bit late, but better late than not. For Paul, WS2N with the SpaceNet report. So on you go, Paul.
Hey, that's WS2N. And very good. And I got lost early on. I thought we were going to be talking about earthquake readings, you know, with S waves and P waves, the different ones going through the earth. But I found out that wasn't the case either. Anyway, this is WS2N. Call for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Let me just go through a couple of things I've come up with here. One is that Israel is now building a telescope, ultraviolet telescope, to be sent into orbit, geosynchronous orbit, you know, 23,000 miles away from the Earth. So it's going to be called the ultrasat, you know, for ultraviolet astronomy. So the ultrasat is going to be completely built by them and then sent over to Florida, and NASA will launch it for them. So I thought that was pretty good to get another country on board to build their own telescope. You know, European Space Agency, of course, is always involved with telescopes, but now they just want to build their own. And now, since it's going to that particular elevation, it's a lot harder to launch a heavy telescope to that geosynchronous orbit. So they're making this on a small side. It's only going to weigh 300-500 pounds. But the idea of it is to detect ultraviolet rays, but quickly. It's going to scan the whole sky on a regular basis. Half the sky. It'll always be working on, looking out away from the Earth. But of course, that changes every 12 hours. It'll be on the other side of the Earth. So the idea is, if it sees something, flash, it could be anything from a black hole interacting with another black hole, or creating a gravitational wave. Anyway, there are transmissions from the ultrasat will go down to other satellites, either space satellites or Earth satellites. This way they can quickly point those satellites to those areas that this thing detects. So it's kind of like a find-a-scope, a fancy find-a-scope in space. It's going to find something real quick, and then even LIGO is going to get involved. It might be a gravitational wave, and then LIGO will be able to see what's coming across. They'll be able to compare the differences. Of course, LIGO has two locations, one in Louisiana and one in the state of Washington, and that's always to verify one or the other, make sure that they truly did see an event. So good for Israel. I'm glad to see they'll be on board with this. This thing should be delivered and launched by NASA. I think 2026 is when they plan on launching it. So we'll see. That should be added to the large amount of space telescopes that we have. Let me drop it. Before I go on, is there anybody with questions or comments for the SpaceNet report in general before we continue?
It's great. AFTP said that.
Oh, very good. I'm sorry, you went by too quick. I missed the call. Well, all I got was Papa chopping in and out. Try one more time.
Call is Alpha Foxtrot 2 Papa. AF2B.
Very good. No breaking up at all that time. AF2P, go ahead for any comments.
Yeah, your SpaceNet reports, when I get a chance to hear them, I always just love them. They're wonderful, I think.
Yeah, thanks for that. I try to compress any of the things that are currently going on. I used to like all the real history, go back to the early days and all. But there's so much happening currently that I try to stick with that. Of course, what's on the internet, of course, is popular. But I still look through magazines and then compare them to all the raw articles to see if they're really something worth talking about. There's so many launches going up on a regular basis. The United States, we've launched over 100 rockets last year, and the European Space Agency, and India, and China. There's hundreds and hundreds of launches, and we can't, of course, cover them all. And some of them are repetitious now. For instance, the stalling program. You know, it seems like every week SpaceX is putting another stalling up, another 50 satellites. Now they're up to almost 4,000 satellites. But to cover that every day is too much. But this is interesting. I thought, and it's relatively small. I mean, I saw a picture, but it doesn't look like a big thing at all. But, you know, they're going to pay for the building of it, and they just need NASA to put it into space. You know, naturally solar-powered batteries, big enough batteries where when they get eclipsed, when, you know, every 12 hours they'll be facing away from the sun, so you know, they have enough battery power to go day in, day out, year in, year out, hopefully. Let me continue on here. This is WSUS. Okay, no, I dropped out. There's a cruise, they call it Crew 6 flight, going up, actually, I'll call it tonight, but it's really after the net, at 1:45 tomorrow morning, so 2 hours and 45 minutes after this net ends, usually at 11 o'clock, NASA is launching four more people to the International Space Station using the Dragon vehicle. Built, of course, by SpaceX, calling the mission Crew 6. Roughly every 6 months or so, this has been going on for the last couple of years. And they'll be joining seven other people right now, presently, on board the space station. And these four people have been working together for a while, getting ready for the mission. You got the commander, Stephen Bowen. Pilot is Woody Holberg. You have a Russian cosmonaut, Edib, I think it is, Edib, he's from Russia, and then another one from the United Arab Emirates, what's his name, Eludai is his last name, Sultan Eludai. Anyway, he's got a trip to the space station for 6 months. They'll all be up there for 6 months, and that means the other crew that's been up there already for 6 months will be coming back shortly. They always do that, but, you know, if there's a replacement crew, the replacement crew always goes up first, and they wind up with, in this case, 11 people on board the station, and then shortly after that, the other people, in this case four of them, will be returning on the Dragon spacecraft that they went up with. So you got a bunch of vehicles attached to the space station. Now you have, let's see, and you'll have two crew vehicles. You have a Cygnus cargo vehicle that's presently attached to the space station. You have two Progress vehicles, that's cargo vehicles from Russia. They're also attached to the space station, as well as now you have two Soyuz crew vehicles attached to the space station. And the reason for that is one of them that just came up was unmanned. They just sent supplies, but it's a regular manned vehicle that will be attached to the space station for the next 6 months, and even so it came up empty. It's going to go back full to Russians and Frank Rubio, the American astronaut. Those three came up on the other vehicle that they call MS-22, and this one is MS-23. MS-22 was in the news a while back in December, with the ammonia leak coming out of the radiators, and they realized that is not safe for the crew to go back in. Although they will eventually deorbit that particular vehicle that's leaking, and it will land in Kazakhstan with its big parachute, they still won't be able to evaluate really what went wrong, because the leak is in the service module of the Soyuz vehicle. If you look at the Soyuz vehicle, it has like three components. The front part is the orbital module, and that's, you know, you can put a crew in there for a while and hang out. They have a bathroom in there and all that. And you could live quite a long time in the orbital module. And then the middle section is the descent module, and that's what the crew sits in. You see a launch from Russia, and they have pictures of the three people tightly squeezed in. That's the crew module, or the descent module. It's also the ascent module. So they get in that, and that's what they come back on. Behind that, the third part is the service module. Service module is the part with, you have all your electronics, coming from your solar panels, and you have all your water supplies, and you have all your tanks for breathing and all, and then you also have your propulsion, your main propulsion for your for the spacecraft. And then, of course, you have your radiators, and the radiators have these aluminum tubes and these plates that go up to get rid of the heat from inside that spacecraft. And they use an ammonia pump system. That ammonia has all leaked out. Apparently, some kind of a small pinhole. They say it's 12 millimeters. They claim it was hit by a meteor. Well, that's probably what did it. Thing flying through space, maybe 30,000 miles an hour or something. And they were going with that for a while, until recently, or a few weeks ago, they looked at one of the Progress Soyuz vehicles that are attached to the space station, and they noticed that they took a reading, and that thing had leaked as well through the radiator system. So, a coincidence, they both get hit with little micrometeors, and or was it a defect in the system before it was launched? And they said, of course, on this one that they just sent up, MS-23, they of course checked that over with a fine-tooth comb. And hopefully that'll be fine, because that has to stay attached to the space station now all the way until September. And September is now when this crew will go back. They're going to be up there like for a year. They were supposed to go up for 6 months. They're going to be up there like now for a year, that crew of three, because of this leak. So because of scheduling or anything, things like that, they're not bringing this crew right back. They always want to, leave. They need people on board, especially Russians. Keep that Russian side of the International Space Station occupied. Any comments? WS2. Okay, well, I should leave a little bit more pause for Echo Link. I tend to forget that. Let me stand by.
WB2BXL here. I stepped away for a while. I'm back. Have you talked about SpaceX yet?
A little bit. They have so much going on. I talked about the Starlink. They have like 4,000 satellites up there now, and of course the mission that's going off after the snap, 1:45 in the morning, of a crew going up to the space station. That's pretty much it for SpaceX. What are you thinking about, Frank? These topics, the big project that they got going on in Boca Chica, Texas, with their spaceship. Hopefully that goes well. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, that's actually the one I'm most interested in. Haven't seen too much on that, of the Super Heavy, or what some people call a BFR. being built in Boca Chica. I know they tried to fire all the engines, and last I heard, fired all but two fired, and I think Lynn Shotwell said, or maybe Musk said, that they thought if they had actually tried to go to orbit with that, they would have made it with two engines out. So they're supposedly ready to go sometime in March. Hard to believe. What do you think, Ed?
I heard that he claims he's ready. Well, the news is really coming through also through, like you said, Shotwell. She's the president, handles this stuff more directly than he does. And you know, she says they're ready. But the problem is they don't have their official license from the government. Or the FCC has to approve it. And they're still waiting on that. And that could slow things down. We'll see. Not sure what the hold up is on that. They have all these environmental things that they've been trying to go, you know, one thing after the other to try to get these approvals. And now with only two engines that didn't fire, they have to question why did they shut one down before it went? What was wrong with that one? Could that happen to the other 31 engines? After they fired, one of them did shut down by themselves. That quit. Again, could that be a problem with the other engines? And I guess that, yeah, if they say they're ready, they could have made it to orbit. Yeah, I heard that too, Frank. That they, oh, yeah, it would have made it to orbit. It probably would. But this is the first flight. Do they really want to? Well, the government really want to let them launch with, well, maybe, maybe not. Or will they make them go through, you know, another complete test and make sure all 33 engines fire? Talking about 17 million pounds of thrust. And now when these things fired, you might correct me on it, but wasn't it only like 50% that they brought the power up? They didn't even bring it up all the way. So, you know, once they do that, you're looking at 17 million pounds of thrust. That's like twice the amount of thrust that the Space Launch System just launched with on Artemis to send that thing around the moon. So I don't know. They said, yeah, they said March, but I don't know yet. It's still doubtful in my mind. You know, why don't they have the final paperwork from the government? Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, I would think, I heard that too, that they still don't have a launch license. I think they have the FCC license to run the Starlink radios under an experimental call sign. I don't think they have the FAA launch license yet, if I remember correctly. I would think that that for national security reasons, the federal government, DOD, is going to want them to go because, and this is purely a guess on my part, but I would think DOD would want to demonstrate the capability to drop supplies into Taiwan from space if they have to. So proving that Starlink works and could conceivably do that would be pretty cool for the United States. So, okay.
Okay, and this is WS2N. Yeah, sure. Everybody, people are lined up to use that thing. Absolutely. NASA wants to get that thing working. Eventually, they have to have some kind of Starship ready for the human landing system to go from lunar orbit down to the moon and back up again. And yeah, I said FCC, that's my ham radio head. FAA is what I meant to say. You're right, Frank. Very good. We'll watch them. And of course, we'll definitely talk about it here. you don't know about the Starship, they plan on launching this thing from Boca Chica, Texas, down near Brownsville. They've set up like a whole small town. Actually, the town's getting bigger now. And they call it the town Stargate. He likes all these fancy names. And they plan on launching these things on a regular basis from that location. And the first test flight will be, first orbital test flight, and they've done other tests from there, successfully launched the top half of the vehicle called called Starship. And that's gone up as high as, 10 miles or so, and then came back down and landed. The last one landed vertically. The ones before that blew up. And now they plan on doing the same thing, except with a booster. Like Frank said, they're going to put a massive booster down called the Super Heavy. Then the Starship will go on top of that. And they plan on setting this thing... Well, the first test will be launched from Texas. The booster eventually plans on returning that back to land to be reused. Same for the Starship, the top part of it. They plan on reusing that as well. So the whole thing is supposed to be reusable. But on the first test flight, they just want to see if this thing gets off the ground. The booster is scheduled not to be reused. It's going to land in the Gulf of Mexico. And then that's the end of that. There's no drone ship out there waiting like they usually do for Falcon 9. It's going to go down the drink. And then the same for Starship itself. It's going to go around the Earth. And see, to me, it's not even an orbital or complete orbital flight. It's not going to make it all the way back. It's going to get as far as Hawaii and ditch in the North Pacific Ocean. That's going to sink to the bottom of the sea as well. So that's what they plan on doing. And then if that's successful, and then you'd be able to see probably flight after flight. They have a lot of these things coming out of their Starship factory down there in Boca Chica. They're developing one right after the other. There's actually a couple of them that are almost ready to fly if this one doesn't make it. Any comments?
Yeah, the one other interesting thing I saw was that they sold their oil platforms, the ones they had, the Chris and the Phobos and Phobos and Deimos, that they intended to modify, convert into launch platforms for Super Heavy, and decided they're not going to do that. So I don't think anybody knows what's with that yet. Go ahead.
Yeah, I read that, Frank. They bought two of them, and like you said, they named them Phobos and Deimos for the moons of Mars, you know. And the plan was to float these things out and see, and eventually launch their Starship from those platforms. That has temporarily been done away with. They scrapped both of those. I think they scrapped it for like $7 million or something. Somebody took them over. So that's out. And if they do this in the future, plans are to eventually have a different setup altogether. He's thinking about maybe a long barge type of thing. You know, I can't imagine what he's going to build. You know, knowing him, it'll be as big as a freaking aircraft carrier or something. But those old oil platforms, and they were massive. I'm looking at pictures. Saved a couple of them to my computer. Massive things, massive oil platforms, you know, many stories high above the sea, and they were floating platforms, so they could have floated anywhere. But yeah, that's gone, Frank. I agree. You're right about that. I just want to get to this one other launch that's coming up, because it's coming up shortly on March 8th. It's by a company called Relativity. They're launching what they call the Terran 1 rocket. Terran 1 rocket, it's got a just one engine that right now called the correction. It's got a the one engine is called the Ariane 1 rocket engine. It's a methane engine, and it produces 23,000 pounds of thrust. You're going to put 9 of them on the bottom, so you're going to get, you know, almost 10 times that amount of thrust out of this thing. And then it's going to have, that first stage separates, second stage comes on, and it has one engine. But all methane, liquid methane. If they're successful, it'll be the first liquid methane, liquid oxygen rocket to actually achieve orbit. And this happens on March 8th. So I'm looking forward to that. It's a company, like I said, called Relativity. They've been at this since, 2017. They're not putting anything into orbit. This is a test, though. They'll probably just have, you know, this heavy weight to, that they'll use payload or something. But the gimmick behind this, not a gimmick, I guess the importance as far as this company is concerned, is the whole rocket and the engine are all 3D printed. So you have a lot of engines today that are being developed that are going through 3D printing technology, including like Rocket Lab does it with their Rutherford engine. They put 9 engines
on time, the
first stage and 1 engine in the second stage, and then, you know, 3D printed. Originally, Peter Beckelone's Rocket Lab, he planned on building his whole rocket with 3D, a 3D setup, but he opted out of that idea. But these people in Relativity didn't. So if this goes well, they'll be able to put these, you know, manufacture rocket after rocket and countless engines after engines. But we'll see. I'd like to see them succeed. The more the merrier for our country to have these people succeed. Let me drop it. They have a massive building in California that contains this 3D traction, which is, I don't know, it looks like, when you look at this 3D machine, it looks like it's, I don't know, 3 stories high or something. It's just a larger contraption, and that's going to mass produce these rockets in the future. If the Tehran one is successful, they plan on building more of these things. They have other engines that are coming out that are going to be more powerful, and then they're eventually working to have reusable first stage. I mean, it might come to the point where you might someday see the rockets from Relativity eventually coming back and landing back in Florida, similar to what SpaceX does. Okay, a couple of other rockets coming up in the future. Vulcan, I'm looking forward to that. We'll talk about that later on a different net. That's May 4th. Vulcan is going to replace all the Atlas V rockets that we've probably almost 100 launches that they've sent up successfully that NASA has been using, as well as the Delta IV. Delta IV is also being replaced, and this particular rocket, the Vulcan, will be replacing it. On its maiden flight, Vulcan is going to have a lunar lander on board called Peregrine Lander, made by Astrobiotic. So that's confidence to put a lunar lander on board, and a couple of other auxiliary satellites too. So we'll see. Anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night's net. Like you said earlier, Roy, the Club InfoNet comes on Monday night at 8:30. Not like this net. This net starts at 8 o'clock. And They check, take check-ins, and you don't have to be a member to even check in. They go through all the letters there. They'll go through the N's and the W's and the K's and the A's. And eventually they get to IRLPs and eventually EchoLink and the All-Star people. So that's on Monday night. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Paul. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul, for the SpaceNet report, for all that you do here on the technical net, and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it, so thanks. And thanks to everyone who came and participated tonight, even those who didn't participate but came and listened. I appreciate all of you, and I hope you'll join us again, because like everything else, next Sunday we'll be back here at the same time and the same frequency and same net, but different questions, different answers, and some more fun. So as Dick, K2RIW, often would leave the technical net with advice, be kind to each other. That's always good advice. So please be good to each other. This is a hobby. You're supposed to have fun. If you're upset or angry, you know, things aren't working out, you're not doing it right. So please kind of put on a happy face, have fun, and let other people have fun as well. And also, I always like to add Epictetus, a ancient Latin philosopher. He had a great line: it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So please keep your minds open to new things. We live in a spectacular technological golden age where if you blink, you miss something. So try and keep in touch with technology. Don't let it jump over you. Don't become one of those unfortunate people who had a VCR flashing 12 for the last decade of their lives. Embrace the technology. It's a tool for good or bad. It's up to you to decide what it's used for. Anyway, thanks to everyone. Please join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when I do it all over again. And if you're interested in 10 meters and you want to give it a try, as I said, unfortunately, we kind of skip over most of Long Island, but we're there at 28380 every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. Check it out. You can listen to the people that we're talking to. They come in through SkyWave, so at least you'll hear one end of the conversation. Anyway, this is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net, and I am clear.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.